Thanks for downloading Think from KERA 90.1 Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn more and support this program at kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What conditions make a child available for adoption from overseas? Can parents on either side of the transaction ever really understand each other's circumstances and intentions? And what sacrifices must be acknowledged from the perspective of the adopted child? My guest today has given those questions a great deal of thought, both as a journalist covering issues of international and transracial adoption, and as the European-American mother of two biological sons and a daughter adopted from Guatemala. She writes about some of her own experiences with international adoption in the November-December issue of Mother Jones magazine. The article is called, Did I Steal My Daughter? Elizabeth, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here.
You write, the reality is that Flora is my child because something went wrong. Flora is your daughter. Can you explain what that sentence means to you and to your family?
Well, what it means to me is that I used to think of adoption. When I first started going through our adoption process, what I really thought of was, you know, here, this is a really win-win situation. My husband and I would like to add another child to our family, and there's a child out there who needs a family. And after my journey with adoption, which I'm assuming we'll get into more, and after meeting my daughter's Guatemalan mother, I had to question that assumption. And what it means is that her Guatemalan mother went through something that was extremely difficult. And then this, what was extremely difficult was relinquishing her child, and that there was loss on her side. And when we talk about international adoption, I know that when we talk about it in the United States, we talk a lot about the whole spectrum of reproductive rights, and we use the word choice. And I think that when we talk about international adoption, we can't talk about choice in the exact same way. Most oftentimes, women are buckling under some form of oppression, whether or not it's a one-child policy in China, or crushing poverty in other countries, or not having any access to birth control. It's not the same way that we think of choice in this country.
Can you talk about the reasons that you decided to look overseas for your baby?
I can. I think that we were like a lot of American parents, and when we decided that we wanted to adopt, the process that we went through was in some ways very similar to what I went through when I gave birth for the first time. I researched who I thought would be the best doctor or midwife to take care of me, and said to the midwife, I've never done this before. You're more of an expert on it than I am, and I'm kind of in your hands. And we did the same thing with our adoption. We did a lot of research to pick a highly reputable adoption agency, and then we said to them, we're kind of in your hands. And I don't want to say that they strong-armed us into international adoption at all. I live in Minneapolis, it has the largest per capita concentration of internationally adopted people in the U.S., so it's a very sort of a part of our culture. But when we discussed adoption, because we had biological children and because we wanted our third child to be a girl, they really didn't, our agency dissuaded us. They said that they didn't think that we would be good candidates for domestic adoption, that a birth mother probably wouldn't be, a woman isn't a birth mother until actually she has relinquished rights to her child. Someone who is expecting a child is a mother, that an American expectant mother probably wouldn't choose us. And we never really in that conversation had any education about foster care or other options that would be available to us. Our agency had a really reputable and established international adoption program, so we figured that that's what we would do.
Were you sort of bothered by the fact that you didn't, I guess, make good copy for an expectant mother to consider placing her child with you?
No, I was really okay with that. I understood what they were saying. That was okay with me.
I want to get some terminology issues out of the way. You mentioned the fact that it's someone is a mother until she has relinquished her child. For a long time also, we used the term biological parents to describe the people that today are most often called birth parents. Can you talk about the reason for the switch?
Well, I think that as with many things, language is extremely important in adoption, and what we call a birth mother is actually a topic that gets is under debate within the adoption community. Some people prefer the term birth mother. I don't think anyone prefers the term biological mother, because I think that's sort of a very cold, relegates that person to more of a breeder. But other terms that people use are first mother, natural mother. We call our daughter's other mother her Guatemalan mother. And I think it really depends on who you ask. And my personal opinion is that a birth mother should be able to choose her own, whatever term she's most comfortable with and what she feels honors her the most.
So it's the kind of thing that you think it's fair to ask someone how they'd prefer
to have
them referred
to. Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Elizabeth Larson is my guest. She's a journalist who wrote an article called Did I Steal My Daughter in the November-December issue of Mother Jones magazine. How do the terms of international adoptions tend to differ from domestic adoptions that happen in this country?
Well, I think that the main difference, and I'm not an expert on this topic, but there are a lot of differences. The difference that I was concerned about and talking about in my article is that today the vast majority of infants being placed domestically for adoption are in open adoption arrangements. And the vast majority, I should backtrack a minute and say that means that there is some form of agreed upon contact between the birth family and the adoptive family. And that can range anywhere from providing photographs and letters once a year to joining together for birthday parties. It's really, adoptive families and birth families are as individual as snowflakes. These are the whole range of experiences. But the majority of international adoptions are closed, meaning that there is no or little identifying information about a child who's adopted from another country's genetic or biographical information.
And there are some people who look at an international adoption and say, this is great, we won't have the sort of, there was a Halle Berry movie 10 or 15 years ago where the mother of origin comes back and tries to take her child. And some people are afraid of having an open adoption or an adoption where the original parents could come back. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And I think if you talk to adoption experts, and social workers, they would widely acknowledge that some people, again, certainly not all, but some people are attracted to international adoption specifically because they're closed.
The Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute released a study this month that recommended that all adoptees be granted full access to their original birth records upon reaching adulthood. What's your take on that?
I completely support the findings of the Evan B. Donaldson Institute study. I think that it's a human right to have access to your genetic and biological and your story. We live in a world and cultures that are founded on stories, and I think that it's important information to have if it is important to the adoptee. I want to make sure that I'm clear that I think that it's not that I think every single adoptee wants that information. It's just that if they do, I think that they should have the right to. And what I think is really significant about the Adoption Institute's study is that it dispels a widespread belief that opening these records violates birth mother's privacy. And what the study showed was that, in fact, most, it might have been many, if not most, of the birth mothers welcomed the contact. And if they didn't, these situations are handled with a great amount of maturity and respect.
It was pretty interesting reading over that study last night, because it pointed out that the people who have been adopted are the only American adults who aren't able to just sort of routinely file down at the courthouse to the courthouse and get their original birth certificate document.
Right. That's exactly true. And it has different. There are different other daily experiences that they're denied. Imagine if you had to go to the doctor and fill out a medical questionnaire and you had no information and no idea about your health history, or if there were chronic illnesses or diseases that ran in that you were genetically predisposed to.
So let's go back to your story for a minute. What did you know about your daughter's birth family?
Well, I knew a fair amount, and the only thing that I talk about in the story is that we knew that they were poor. And I have a lot more information about it, but as an adoptive mother, I don't share it. And the reason I don't share it is that because I think that that's my daughter's story and part of her privacy. And non-adoptive people don't ever have to answer questions about how they were conceived. So it's sort of just something that I want to keep for my daughter. But I do talk about in the story that poverty was a factor. It was not the only factor, but it was definitely a factor, and I chose to include that because when you're talking about international adoption, you really can't get around that fact.
Yeah, and don't worry, I was not...
I understood that. So.
Yeah. A year or so after you adopted Flora, though, you started thinking more and more about her Guatemalan mother. What made you decide, I've got to go looking for her?
Well, there were several things. In adoption, it's called a referral. So when my daughter was 7 days old, we got a picture of her and said that, you know, with meaning that this was the child that was slated to become our child through adoption, and at the end of the adoption process, she would be legally ours. During that process, and it was a 7-month wait, we had inquired of our social worker whether or not her Guatemalan mother would like to keep in contact and know us. And the reason we asked is that Guatemala is one of the few countries that you can adopt from where there is some possibility of having an open relationship. And we had gone through our pre-adoptive counseling with our agency and had definitely gotten the message that when it comes to adoption, openness is a very good thing, that sort of the old-fashioned rules apply, that secrets are harmful and honesty is the best policy. So our hope was that if we could start out in an open situation, that would be most beneficial to our daughter. And what happened was a week before we traveled to Guatemala City to finalize the adoption, we got a call saying that our daughter's Guatemalan mother had moved back to her village. And that concerned me only in that I knew from the records that she was from Guatemala City. And it made me concerned that we weren't being told the exact truth. And it just was a little concern that lodged in my mind.
Did you actually worry sincerely that perhaps she had been coerced in some way to give her daughter for adoption?
It was the darkest worry that I had. I wouldn't say it was an incredibly rational worry, but it was there for me.
Journalist Elizabeth Larson is my guest. Her piece, Did I Steal My Daughter?, is in the November-December issue of Mother Jones Magazine. We'll continue the conversation after a break, and if you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering adults an opportunity to think for credit. Details on the web at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is journalist Elizabeth Larson. Her article, Did I Steal My Daughter?, appears in the November-December issue of Mother Jones magazine. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I wonder, let's backtrack just a little bit, Elizabeth, to the day that you went to actually pick up Flora, because you found her in the care of someone who cared very much about her and learned that, in fact, her Guatemalan mother had been part of her life up until that point.
Yes. One thing I want to make sure I mention is that Flora is the name that I use for her in the story, and it's not actually her real name. And I changed it, again, to provide her some degree of privacy. So if I stumble sometimes over it, that's why. When we went to Guatemala City, the way that the private adoption system works there is that a lot of the children are cared for by foster families who are paid by the lawyers who facilitate the adoptions. And her foster mother was a really lovely woman who loved her very deeply, had cared for her, had taken her home from the hospital when she was 2 days old, and had raised her from until she was 6 months old. And we were having lunch together and talking, and I asked her if she knew my daughter's Guatemalan mother. And she said that she did, and she said that she's a very loving, very affectionate woman. And I think that my daughter's foster mother was sort of sizing us up to see what kind of people we were. And in fact, after the questions, said, "I have a gift for her. Her Guatemalan mother gave her a stuffed animal. I will bring it to you." It was very comforting to me because it came out in the conversation that she had seen her several times while she was in foster care. And it really was sort of the first inkling that I had that this was someone who cared and loved this child very deeply.
Yeah, you write this line that I think is so moving. You say somewhere a woman was coming to terms with the fact that she would never see her baby again, speaking about your baby's Guatemalan mother. And I wonder if it's a difficult thing to come to terms with that this is a child who did have other people who loved her, that in some ways it would be easier for you to accept that you were taking her into your family if you didn't even have to think about where she came from.
I think that is true. I think that it is a complicated... I had originally titled the story A Complicated Privilege, and I think that that sums up my feelings about adoption. And that my daughter wasn't an orphan in the traditional sense of what we think about when we think orphans. She had a mother and a father who were alive at the time of the adoption.
So how did it happen that you were able to actually meet with her mother, you know, after this year had passed and you came to feel like it was very important to you?
What happened was when we decided that we felt that it was important to get in touch with her, and we felt, and again, I want to preface that by saying that I hope that this doesn't sound like I think this is what every adoptive family should do. I think, again, all situations are different, and it depends on birth families and the adoptee and the adoptive family. But we decided, we felt, we had a strong inkling based on things we'd heard from our foster mother that our daughter's Guatemalan mother would want to know how she was doing. And we also didn't want our daughter's life before our family to be a black hole that she couldn't retrieve. We did not want to put our daughter's foster mother in any jeopardy with the attorney by asking her to be that conduit. So we hired a searcher. And searchers usually operate sort of by word of mouth. They don't have, at least in Guatemala, they don't have a website that you can go to. As it worked out, I had a friend who had used this searcher and had recommended her, and we sent her an email and then made contact with her, sent her some documents, and she went out and found her, actually, quite easily.
And how did the meeting go?
With the searcher?
No, with your daughter's mother, Guatemalan mother.
With the searcher and our daughter's Guatemalan mother, mm-hmm. or when we actually ended up meeting her?
When you met her.
Well, I would say 8 months later, my husband and I took our daughter to Guatemala to meet her, and it was probably, in my opinion, the biggest privilege of my life. It was exceedingly emotional. Obviously, there were a lot of tears, but a lot of incredibly warm feelings kind of going back and forth between these two different families. And again, what I came away from that experience feeling most deeply was the fact that she really did love this child, and it was a tremendous relief for her to see that this child was alive, that she was thriving, that she was loved, that she was doing well.
Did you worry, Elizabeth, that you might come away from that experience feeling less like Flora was truly your daughter than you in fact did?
I think that a lot of parents worry about that. And I certainly would say that that was there for me. By the time we got there, though, we had had enough information sort of mediated back and forth through the searcher that I just really felt that for our particular family, that it was just really the right decision. So I wasn't that concerned about it when I got there.
Elizabeth Larson is my guest. She's a journalist who wrote a piece called Did I Steal My Daughter for the November-December issue of Mother Jones magazine. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Joel in Denton writes, I have concerns regarding the cultural questions that may not be answered by American adoptive parents. I feel that impoverished children in any place should be helped, but I don't know if transplantation is the answer. And you definitely have had some thoughts on this issue.
Yes, I have. I think that's an excellent point to raise, and it is a question that I think right now is getting a lot of discussion in the adoption community. And there's sort of, I don't know if I would call it a debate. I think it's more of a conversation about what's in the best interest of a child. I think that in the best case scenario, if a child can be raised by their families, their original families, that is the best case scenario. And also I think that domestic adoption is extremely important in these countries, and that there's a great deal of gain that comes from international adoption and a great deal of loss, and that we can't gloss over either the gains or the losses in the discussion, that they kind of go hand in hand.
And even once a child has been adopted or placed for adoption, there's still some controversy about whether or not to provide any kind of material support to the original family. And I'm wondering if you can talk about what the hazards are perceived to be of that.
Absolutely. The biggest ethical concern, it is entirely legal to provide some sort of monetary aid or scholarships for children in families once the adoption is finalized. Any exchange of money beforehand is completely illegal. But the ethical concerns about providing financial assistance to birth families even after the adoption has more to do with whether or not if people in the community know that someone is getting help for having placed a child, I think that the concern is that would provide an incentive in someone who is living in dire poverty to possibly decide to place a child of their own for adoption. So there's concern that it could create an incentive.
How does it happen that children are, in fact, and this was turned out not to be the case with you, but the children are sort of stolen for adoption and often without the knowledge of their adoptive parents, were placed without the consent of their actual parents?
Well, I think that also varies from country to country, and I'm not an expert on that topic, but what I do know is that oftentimes And again, sometimes you'll read stories. I think that they're not that common, but you'll read stories of children being stolen outright of mother's arms. But I think a more common scenario is that a family may place a child in an orphanage not because they want them to be adopted, but because they cannot feed them, and they take them there for a sort of a stopgap measure. And then something happens where someone is not acting entirely above board and without notifying those parents puts that child in the adoption pipeline.
Is this a big money sort of criminal industry as far as you can tell?
Well, I think that a lot of adoption experts would say that the answer is true, that that's true. Again, I'm not an expert in that, so I would be reluctant to weigh in on that.
As a parent who has one adopted child and two that you gave birth to yourself, can you compare the experience of bonding with each of your children and even your approach to parenting?
Yeah, what I like to say and how I describe it to my friends is that I love both my sons who I gave birth to and my daughter who joined my family through adoption the same. I love them with the same intensity and passion, but I do feel that raising them is different. There are different things that my husband and I think about when we are raising our daughter versus raising our sons, and one of them really does have to do with the fact that we didn't give birth to her, and there's another group of people that are invested in her in another country. Also, she is Latina, and we are Caucasian, and we have to think a lot about what that's like for her in terms of having her learn how to navigate race and racism when she lives in a family that doesn't experience it on a daily basis and can't really teach her that from the inside.
So in other words, yeah, that's an interesting point, that you may not have experienced racism in anywhere near to anywhere near the extent that she might be faced with it in her life.
Yes.
Yeah. Does it make it easier in some ways that she looks so different from you, so that it won't ever be, you know, it won't ever be something that she sort of has to reveal to people who know her well? It'll be obvious.
No, I don't know how. It certainly is it's an obvious fact when you see our family together that she was adopted. And I don't know whether or not that makes it easier or more difficult. And I think that will sort of play out as she gets older.
You've done a lot of other reporting, I know, on Americans who now are adults but were adopted as infants or as small children from overseas. What have you been able to learn from them about, if there is one, the best way to sort of structure a transracial or transnational adoption?
Oh, wow. What I've learned from them is that there's no one way that works the best. again, that all experiences are different. I think that the most important single piece of wisdom that I've learned from adults who are adopted from Korea is how much the discourse about adoption in our culture is driven by adoptive parents, and that it's really important to listen to what transnational adoptees have to say about their experience. And again, those experiences vary widely, but it's just important to recognize that having lived it, they really are the experts.
Do you have any concerns now that the new emphasis on preserving and perhaps creating the rights, particularly of the adopted children themselves, will marginalize the ability of adoptive parents to control how their child's lives are structured and what story they choose to present to their children?
No, that's actually not something that I think it's a really good question, but it's not something that I have any concerns about.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like communicating with other adoptive parents, you talked about how every story is so different. I would imagine it's the same way when you try and say, well, did this happen to you? Do you learn much talking to other adoptive parents, or are all the circumstances so vastly different that there's not too much that you can gain from that?
I think that talking with other adoptive parents has been very valuable to me. Not necessarily. I've certainly learned a lot of pearls of wisdom that have informed my parenting. But I think it's also just important for my daughter to be in a community where there are other families that are like hers, and where she is in regular contact with other children who share her unique and special circumstances.
What was it hard to let go of the feeling that you had sort of rescued your daughter from a poorer life and set that aside and just have her be your child?
No, I think, again, that we had received some really excellent pre-adoptive counseling on that matter. And, in fact, our social workers were very clear at one of the training sessions that if we were doing this adoption because we wanted to rescue a child, that that actually wasn't fair to the child. You need to adopt because you really want in your heart and soul to have a child, or in our case, another child.
And how about your sons? How have they dealt with all the very complicated issues that this has raised?
Well, they're really quite young. They're 8 and 5, and they were even younger when their little sister was adopted. So for them, it's really just a very normalized part of our life. I had been very prepared that people would come up and ask us questions, and I had read that oftentimes when people are trying to piece together how the family and how the people fit together, they don't ask the parents, and instead they ask the children and the family. So I had been prepared for that and had been on the lookout for that with my sons, just to see if they were having to be the unofficial spokespeople for how our family was built, and it hasn't really come up yet.
That's very funny to think that people are embarrassed to ask you, but yeah. They would go after your 8-year-old. Elizabeth Larson is my guest. She's a journalist who wrote a piece called Did I Steal My Daughter for the November-December issue of Mother Jones Magazine. We'll return to our discussion after the break, and we will take more of your calls and emails. Email address, as always, is think@kera.org. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering adults an opportunity to think for credit. Details on the web at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Elizabeth Larson. Her article, Did I Steal My Daughter?, appears in the November-December issue of Mother Jones Magazine. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So I guess, Elizabeth, you have a couple of different kinds of choices at this point, you and your husband. Not only you decide how you will tell this story to your daughter, but also what details you might wait and allow her to ask for herself as opposed to you just giving her when the time is appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's exactly true. And I would be lying to say that I have a formula down that I think will work perfectly. We will sort of grope our way through this as best we can. I think that the most important thing that my husband and I think about is we provide her with information that just helps her know that she's adopted. We talk about that a lot. That's appropriate to how old she is. And then the rest of it, I think we have to follow her lead and follow her questions. We show her pictures of our time together in Guatemala, and we really celebrate that. But a lot of the meaning-making of this is going to be hers. And is really her journey that may or may not include us. Of course, she's our child and we adore her, so we want to support her in any way we can.
It also seems like it would be hard not to be impatient, since you want to do the right thing. In other words, she's how old now, two or three?
She's three.
So I would imagine she's not really that interested in sustained conversations about all these things that right now are really a huge part of your thinking, of your emotions.
Yes, you've definitely articulated a very important dichotomy that goes on in our family. She really is much more interested in playing with her brothers. And while her father and I are thinking through more of these big picture ideas.
It sounds like you both prepared yourselves for all of the things that might come up. But I'm wondering if there are things that you expected to struggle with when you adopted your daughter, and whether they're fundamentally different from the things that you actually deal with today in terms of her place in your family and her adoption.
That's a wonderful question. And I think that the thing that I wasn't prepared for, or that I just didn't give any thought to, was just that I would come to see adoption as joyous and wonderful, but also complicated. And I just didn't think that I would see it in a very complicated way. I think I thought it would be much more of a black and white experience for me, and that I wouldn't grapple with issues about the ethics of adoption and how, and think about how international adoption can be best served by reforms that will make it a better process for birth families, for adopted people and adoptive parents.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, I mean, obviously we're a nation of mostly immigrants, but you had to come to terms with the idea that your daughter sacrifices her sort of Guatemalan nationality in a large way.
Mm-hmm. And that, again, Well, the reason that I was thinking about that came from a lot of conversations that I had with adults who were adopted from Korea. And what they had said was that sort of some of them, again, not all, that sort of the central paradox of their life was that inwardly they identified themselves as white because that's what they grew up in. And, you know, I talked to a lot of today, you know, we grew up eating Swedish meatballs and having Scandinavian traditions. And then when they went to college, the college organizations were asking them to join the Asian Students Union and other things, and they were thinking to themselves, well, I'm not Asian. And so that's sort of what got me thinking about that, is that we would love for our daughter to grow up feeling really proud that she was born in Guatemala and was adopted from Guatemala and has a family, another family in Guatemala. But our efforts to be able to teach her about Guatemala are limited by the fact that we're not Guatemalan and that we don't have an insider's view and understanding of the culture.
Yeah, it's an interesting issue, and you talk about, you know, super parenting and the hazards of that. But, you know, you don't really necessarily know how far to take it, at what point it becomes ridiculous, and at what point it's really appropriate and beautiful.
Right. And again, I think that is something that just has to unfold as our daughter gets older. And we have to take her cues and see if she's not interested in that part of her life. That's really her choice. And she gets to be who she wants to be.
Is there anything that you wish that you had known that you didn't before you adopted Flora?
I think I wish that I had been more immersed in discussions about the ethics of adoption and what makes for an ethical adoption and what makes, you know, for an adoption that might not be quite as ethical. And I know that sounds sort of abstract and vague, but I don't think that we have a very sophisticated national conversation going on right now about who should be adopted, what children should, you know, maybe we should be putting more of an emphasis on preserving families and keeping families intact versus solving problems through adoption.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. The email address is think@kera.org. We have an email from Juanita who says, I understand why you wanted to be very private about telling parts of your daughter's story, but that makes me wonder why you want to tell any of it. Can you talk about that?
I absolutely can, and that's a great question, too. I started the story as a reported story with no first-person component at all. And that's the way it was. I had pitched it to my editor, and that's the way that I started. And as, in the course of my reporting, I would send emails to my editor and say, this is a point I want to make. And as an aside, I'd say, I understand this from my own personal life. And she's the one who said, why aren't you telling this? And at first I said, well, I'm not going to tell it because this is my daughter's story and I don't have a right to tell it. And then I had to take a hard look at myself, and I realized that because I'm an adoptive parent, my bias about these subjects would be dripping all over the page. And I was going to dig, and I'm a good reporter, and I would have gone as far as I needed to find families who would have said the exact same things that I wanted to say and my insights that I wanted to say about the story. So I decided that I thought it was the right thing to discuss this from my perspective. That doesn't mean that I didn't think it was complicated and that I still don't have concerns about telling something that's so private to my child. So what I did was I just took a few steps that I thought would protect her privacy a little bit more. I changed her name. And she and I have different last names, and I also didn't talk about, quote, describe anyone in her Guatemalan family except her birth mother, because her birth mother gave me her express permission. And that was the other reason why I decided to tell the story, is that I was talking with her Guatemalan mother, and I was saying that someday, I explained that I was a journalist, and I said someday I'd really like to write about mothers whose children are adopted into America. And I said, you know, in America we don't hear these people's stories very much. And I was having this conversation with her purely just as talking about the kind of work that I do. And she looked at me and she said, well, will you please tell my story? Will you please tell the American people how much I love my child? And I did feel some sense of responsibility, I think, to share that experience.
And the title of the piece, which in the magazine is Did I Steal My Daughter, was that yours? Was that an editor's?
Editors love provocative titles, mm-hmm. and especially when they coincide with the news cycle, and the news cycle that's going on out of Guatemala right now is raising a lot of unsettling questions. And I think that if you looked, and so it was my editor's decision, she chose that title. She didn't force me into it. I did have a little bit of a flurry of protest. And then she just very sincerely asked me, wasn't that your deepest fear? And I said it was, and thought that it really was an okay title to use. I think that if you look today, especially in online conversations among adoptive parents, you'll see that more and more parents are wanting to undertake searches simply to verify the circumstances of their children's adoptions. But I think that the more prominent and more popular reasons that parents decide to search is because they want their children to have the opportunity to have access to their background information, and they also want to be able to have the birth families know that their children are well-loved and are doing well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Joe in Fort Worth. Hi, Joe.
Hi. A question for your guest. My experience with adoption is transitioning foster kids into adoption, and that's a totally different thing than what you're talking about. But the question I have, we adopted 5 children, and one of them was a failed adoption, and I won't get into the reason for that, but can you talk about, you know, the likelihood of success? What do you know about adoptions that fail?
You know, I don't know very much about that. I've read a few stories about adoptions from Eastern Bloc countries that failed due to severe attachment challenges, but that's really almost all that I know. I'm sorry.
That's okay. 1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number. Let's go next to Jeff in Dallas. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. I wanted to call and say how much I appreciate the story and the conversation today. My wife and I adopted a Guatemalan child some 30 years ago when we were unable to have a second child. Our first child was adopted, and then when I was doing work in Guatemala and was able to adopt a child under similar circumstances, well, with a private party, working through the courts and an attorney. I guess the comment that I'd like to make after all these years is the surprise that we felt and we discovered in just the racism that we witnessed our youngster experiencing. And perhaps it was because we were just living in a transparent world, but our little child was blindsided from time to time by some really unfortunate experiences that opened our eyes to the strident racism that still exists in our culture and the discrimination that a lot of our young people experience.
Jeff, how did your family handle that for the sake of your child?
Well, we confronted it openly, quite frankly. We weren't belligerent about it, but we let it be known rather firmly with the parties involved that we didn't appreciate the remark that had been made or the lack of attention that the student, that our child was receiving in the classroom, as one of the cases was. In one situation, one of the teachers was not even aware that our son, our Guatemalan son, was even in the classroom after a semester.
That is so disturbing. Let me switch it back because we're about to be out of time. And Elizabeth, ask whether or not you have seen anything quite that bad so far.
Not so far, but I think that it is a reality that adoptive families need to face. And I would love to thank the caller for calling in. He's much more of an expert on this than I am, having parented someone for much longer time than I have. But I do think that this is a very important issue.
What are you still sort of learning and working on a daily basis with your daughter and with your family?
Well, definitely race is one of the things that we are learning about and thinking about and trying to figure out our way through it. And having an awareness of race in our daily life is something that we think about a lot, and we think a lot about diversity in our schools, in our community, and that's not something I thought about as much. It was certainly a value of mine, but it wasn't something that was on the hottest front burner of our lives before our adoption.
Elizabeth Larson's article, Did I Steal My Daughter?, appears in the November-December issue of Mother Jones magazine. Elizabeth, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro, with production assistance from Maggie Conklin. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.